Good evening, Bodhisattvas. So the plan is I'm going to give a talk, and then we can talk about that for a couple minutes if we want to, and then it's back to the koans. And if this is the way it happens, I hope it's all right with everybody if we run just a couple minutes past 9 o'clock. We won't run very late. And then is the rumor true about the kitchen after that?
I don't think we've set anything up, but
okay,
it's
yeah. Yeah, we'll talk some more about that afterwards, but there'll be at least a little bit of cake left in the kitchen.
Or a lot,
yeah. So that's the plan. All right. Here's another old story. Once great Master Ma and Bai Zhang were taking a walk when a wild duck flew by. "What's that?" asked the great ancestor. "A wild duck," said Bai Zhang. "Where did it go?" "It flew away." The great ancestor twisted Bai Zhang's nose, and Bai Zhang cried out in pain. "When did it fly away?" asked the great ancestor. As my friend David Greenlee said about something a Japanese Zen master said to his group in Paris, I always thought that was a little harsh. It flew away. Nothing wrong with that. One night in the meditation hall after a talk, David Chadwick writes, he asks Suzuki Roshi to please just once condense all his teachings into something simple that David could understand. "Everything changes," Suzuki said. But Bai Zhang gets his nose twisted hard. "We must be in some other story, or the same place seen from the telescope's other end. In Mu, we say no now, the teachings say. There's only going and coming. In Mu, there's no going or coming." What is it about the nose twist? If your mind or attention is wandering, if you're wondering, say, about what you would do in just such a time, at just such a time, Great Master Ma's hard twist brings you right up into your nose, your face, your ouch, Ma's twisting fingers, Ma, and the great surrounding field and big sky. Nothing missing, no place else to be, and for now, nothing else and no place else. Buzzing, alive, flowing, large, serene, still, silent, eternal, vast, and just right here, all at once. There's nothing else, nothing falls outside this wide, buzzing silence. Same when the duck goes, honk! You come to yourself where you are. All moments are like this if someone twists your nose. Since Great Master Ma kicked me in the chest, another student said, I have not stopped laughing. Hakuin got his nose twisted too. Master Shouju asked Hakuin, tell me, what is Zhao Zhou's Mu? Hakuin elatedly replied, pervading the universe, not a spot whatsoever to take hold of. As soon as he had given that answer, Shouju took hold of Hakuin's nose and gave it a twist. I am quite at ease to take hold of it, said Shouju, laughing aloud. The next moment, he released Hakuin's nose and abused him. You, dead monk in a cave, are you self-satisfied with such mu? This completely put Hakuin out of countenance. Shibayama, who tells this story, tells one on himself too. My teacher also once asked me, show me the form of Mu. When I said it has no form whatsoever, he pressed me, saying, I want to see that form that has no form. How cutting and drastic, Shibayama says. Hakuin again, wizened teacher now, the formless form comes into form. It's like a pneumatic tube at the drugstore or at the old New York Public Library. In a nanosecond, because of the vacuum, no resistance, here it is, whap! Everything arises from causes and conditions, everything changes, yes. But it also shoots right up where you are, brought to you direct from Broadway, right up out of the vastness, not from this vantage or in this kaya, through a long evolutionary course, but in no time at all, out of nothing and nowhere. Tathagata, complete, perfect, offering eternity to your startled gaze and freeing you into it. There's nothing else. When did it ever fly away? But it turns out that's not the story, or not all of the story. though it sounds pretty good to me. But in some way, all this is prelude. Joan's version, beautifully and with an odd understated tenderness, titles the next part Afterward. It's from Yuan Wu's commentary, not from the main case. The next day, Bai Zhang opened completely and began weeping. Someone asked him why, and Bai Zhang told him to ask Ma. Ma sent him back to Bai Zhang, who was now laughing uproariously. "You were just crying. Why are you laughing now?" Bai Zhang replied, "I was crying before. Now I'm laughing." Which is all of the story. The open completely happens not when Bai Zhang's nose gets tweaked, not when I think the buzzing stillness buzzes for him, though that sets things in motion, but it takes some time to ripple and spread through him. When it does, his response is maybe not what we'd expect. Why is he crying? Partly, perhaps, these are tears of relief. Home now, released from separateness and alienation, at home in himself at last. But I think there's something else. Where did it go? It flew away. And it did. It didn't, and it did. The national teacher dies, your dog dies, each thing sinks down, and the wide, vast ocean rolls over it. And at the same time, when did it ever fly away? We can hold them both, and we have to. And they hold us. And there isn't any more logic to it than that, any way to sort it out or untangle or separate one from the other, to clutch the vast and eternal part so it keeps us safe, so it saves us from it flew away. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card I can stick in my back pocket. To me, there's something beautiful and tender about Bai Zhang's tautological response when his questioner presses him for a little more clarity. These things could be a lot clearer without hurting anybody, John Ashbery jokes in a poem. "You were just crying. Why are you laughing now?" Bai Zhang replied, "I was crying before. Now I'm laughing." It's the way it is because it's the way it is. I'm responding the way I am because I'm responding the way I am to this tangle moment by moment. Laughing doesn't supersede crying or solve it. Sometimes I cry, sometimes I laugh. That's all. Both of them acknowledging and accepting the whole ball of wax. With equanimity, Joan says, you let everything in at the gate, and then you feel what you feel. Joan liked to tell a story about her Dharma ancestor a couple transmission generations back. After a big opening, Yamada lay with his head in his teacher Yasutani's lap, weeping. Yasutani, who, as Joan noted, could be pretty fierce, just kept stroking Yamada's head, saying, "I understand, I understand." "That's a tradition," Joan said, "I'm happy to belong to." It's worth noting, though there isn't time to dwell on it, that this Bai Zhang of Blue Cliff Record Case 53 grows up to be the Bai Zhang of Case 2 of The Gateless Gate, Bai Zhang's Fox, which comes right after the big Kensho bang of Case 1, Zhao Zhou's No. Conspicuously, Case 2 declines to place all its chips on black, vastness, though it also doesn't plunk everything down on red, finitude and form. Does an enlightened person fall under the law of cause and effect or not? Guess wrong and you get turned from an abbot into an animal. If you have an eye to see through this, Wu Men comments, then you will know that the former head of the monastery did enjoy his 500 happy lives as a fox. Here's Wu Men's poem on the case. Not falling, not evading, two faces of the same die. Not evading, not falling, hundreds of thousands of regrets. Let me ask you at the end, Shibayama ends his commentary on the case, what kind of life is it, this life of hundreds and thousands of regrets? I should like to point out that the essence of this koan is in the last line. The key of the 500 happy, blessed lives is hidden here. We're the ones who care in the midst of inevitable suffering. The 500 happy lives are not separate, not different from the regrets, and they're not separate from the vastness. If he had not answered wrongly, what would he have become? Wang Bo asks his teacher Bai Zhang. Foxes don't live in exile. One thing I love about Ma's Wild Duck Koan is that it ports the double consciousness of the Seamless Tomb Koan into the everyday. No one is dying in the Duck Koan, at least not as ordinarily understood. But everything changes everywhere and all the time, which, as Bill said last night, is probably where the emphasis falls in Norman's "we think we're alive now and we'll be dead later, but that's baloney" story. Some of us, some parts of us, some aspects of the world are falling away every moment while some other parts are coming into being. So we're alive and we're dead, an evanescence that, maybe because it's ceaseless, also feels timeless and silent and still. Impermanence makes us very quiet. We can take up the precepts right here, where the vastness morphs into and permeates the multitudinous, beautiful, cranky, crotchety, violent world of particular beings. Emperors, ducks, abbots turned into foxes, presidents, assault rifles, dreamers. We talked a lot in our precept study group about the formless precepts, intimations underneath any formulation of how the vastness calls to us and invites us to respond, and about how the formless precepts morph into form and the formal vows, the refuge vows, the three pure vows, the particular interrogations of behavior in the 10 bodhisattva vows. The section on bodhicitta in Norman's Training in Compassion, Zen Teaching on the Practice of Lojong, is useful here and dovetails nicely with our conversation so far, in part because the same double consciousness is crucial to his formulation. Connecting bodhicitta, the impulse or desire for spiritual awakening, with love and concern for others, he begins with the vastness perspective. Absolute bodhicitta is love that amounts to a total vision of life as love itself. With such love, there can be no loss, because this love is so big it includes everything, even absence, so nothing can ever be lost. Absolute bodhicitta is the empty, perfect, expansive, joyful, spacious nature of existence itself. In contrast to this vast perspective, Norman continues, relative bodhicitta is when I roll up my sleeves and get on with the business of actually loving somebody. You may feel exhausted just hearing about relative bodhicitta, he notes a little waggishly, but actually relative bodhicitta is the antidote to fatigue because it is built on a foundation of absolute bodhicitta. If relative bodhicitta is an endless task, absolute bodhicitta is the endless peace that underlies that task, so it's okay. Absolute and relative bodhicitta depend on each other. Without absolute bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta will become forced and we will become angry and worn out with all of our caring and all of our helping. And without relative bodhicitta, absolute bodhicitta becomes a kind of grand abstraction, a big, lofty religious idea with no substance to it. What good is a really big love if it never gets applied to the world? That's the end of the quotation. Maybe plunking this formulation of the double consciousness that supports bodhicitta into the context of the koans we've been pondering can serve to underline how deeply enmeshed the precepts and the ethical engagements that grow out of them are with the deepest imponderables and mysteries to which Zen practice guides us. Perhaps we can find increasingly for ourselves in this double consciousness underlying bodhicitta what lots of people find in Norman's own Zen teaching as well as his poetry: an unceasing, generous willingness to let in and in the deepest sense accompany suffering and loss and hardship as well as joy, together with a pervasive buoyancy and equanimity that makes such a compassion possible and sustainable. Let's double back for a moment to Joan's formulation of equanimity. Contrary to the Zen stereotype, she says, equanimity isn't a matter of a kind of flat line, tamped down uniformity of response. Instead, with equanimity, you let everything in at the gate, and then you feel what you feel. It's the willingness to let the next thing in, whatever it is, whatever life has brought, that's crucial, though this willingness turns out not to manifest itself in the tendency toward histrionic emotional swings. This is certainly a time that tests our willingness to let in all that's happening, and that can tempt us when we do respond to do so in ways not likely to be helpful, with apocalyptic formulations that can serve more to get us overwrought than to help us engage. Part of what overwhelms us might be the sense that the kinds of help we are able to offer don't really count when there's so much suffering. If that's paralyzing, though, it's not helpful, and we're not. It seems to be a time of pernicious and violent othering, and you don't have to go very far to meet someone who's had that other label pinned to them. Amid so many poisonous proclamations and so much demonizing rhetoric, even a little softness in a simple interaction with someone can make a difference. One kind of engagement, of course, doesn't preclude another. How about multiple shifting constellations of bodhisattva tactical intervention squads? And everyone who aspires to be a bodhisattva is one. In recent conversations in Desert Rain Zen, there seems to be a loose and provisional consensus that we don't want to take official positions as a sangha, Desert Rain Zen for Dreamers placards say, but that some of us might want to band together and hook up with other local Dharma groups for collective action. Joan's list of wildly disparate kinds of bodhisattvas in her Vimalakirti book seems at least as useful now as it ever did, or to be honest about it, when I read it in a talk last year. It reminds us that not everyone is skilled in the same way, and that your reluctance to invest yourself in one situation or in one way doesn't vitiate your enthusiasm and energy for doing so in another. Now here's the long quotation again. Some of you have heard this many times with Joan and read it and so on. But Vimalakirti implies that we bodhisattvas in training should avoid thinking of the bodhisattva as a template of perfection we're going to squeeze ourselves into. In an off-balance world that invites our flexibility and improvisation, there are a lot of different ways to be a bodhisattva, and the sutra names many of them. I used to think that this was just part of the tendency in the old texts to elaborate, the chiliocosms upon chiliocosms and all the wonderful jewels, flowers, music. But now I think this is actually a deep Dharma point. There isn't a bodhisattva. There are unblinking bodhisattva, wonderful arm bodhisattva, jewel hand bodhisattva, lion mind bodhisattva, pure emancipation bodhisattva, universal maintenance bodhisattva, jewel courage bodhisattva, roots of joy bodhisattva, joyful vision bodhisattva, sounds of thunder bodhisattva, serene capacity bodhisattva, store of virtue bodhisattva, delights in the real bodhisattva. And then there are three that clearly show the absence of a single template for our spiritual lives. Viewing equality bodhisattva, viewing inequality bodhisattva, and viewing equality and inequality bodhisattva. This is just a fraction of the titles in the sutra, and the invitation is to discover your particular expression of bodhisattvaness. In the tilti world, you figure out whether you're jewel hand bodhisattva or roots of joy bodhisattva, understanding that you might be different bodhisattvas at different times in your life, and maybe more often than not, feeling a little bit humble about it. Fingers crossed bodhisattva, pretty close bodhisattva, not a bad morning bodhisattva, flying by the seat of my pants bodhisattva. And how about no more AR-15s bodhisattva? Protect the dreamers in Tucson or Santa Fe or Seattle bodhisattva, or squash the Russian bots bodhisattva. But as Joan makes clear in her recent ongoing series of writings about our present moment, which shared the title The Myth We're In, it's also a time in America that asks us for self-examination as well as compassionate action. And I'm going to slide on out of here mostly with quotations from that right now. Toward the end of the most recent installment, she writes, "Somewhere underneath the slogans on hats and pundit shouting matches is a mournful truth. There are a lot of ways to suffer in this life. We do better or worse day to day handling that. Suffering shouldn't pit us against each other. It's the existential condition we share. The only question really is what we're going to do about it. It's a noble question, that one. a question full of grace. And at the very end, where I hear equanimity underlying and enabling this call to engagement. Whatever comes next, I hope we stay faithful to this threshold moment, which we would call endarkenment. In this part of the ceremony, endarkenment means accepting the devastating gift of humiliation, opening to the grief of others, acknowledging our shadow. It awakens the desire to make amends where amends are needed. We can't force endarkenment on others, but we can take it on ourselves. We have done it sometimes, we Americans, and we can do it again. But deeper this time, more thoroughgoing, wholehearted. It's past time. Let us, for all our sakes, get this done. Thank you. So I think the plan now, since we don't know whether we're talking about the talk or about the cones, is we're going to kind of slide in to something like a circle so that we can talk a little more closely. And anybody who'd like to stay in a chair can do that. And I think also, since we don't know if we're talking about the cones or the talk, I'll probably turn the recorder off now, I think. Yeah, so.